insanity defense, proves unequivocally, in our opinion, that it also had an effect when the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mark Weishart intended to kill. We ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court in order that the writ be granted.
So just on this jury thing for one second, is it your notion that the submission of this affidavit shifted the burden of production to the state or the burden of persuasion?
I'm not sure. I think that what the state had to do was prove that there was no prejudice from it. There isn't a constitutional. The state could have easily taken the position this is only part of the constitutional obligation because there's no harm from it. I think they had to do something. It might be presenting argument and evidence from the transcript or presenting additional evidence. It would be up to them to choose how they would factually respond to it, if that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Longshot. Mr. Creason?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The jury was aware of all of the operative facts relating to the credibility of Gregory Scott Johnson.
Were there not some significant restrictions that the trial court was placing on defense counsel's cross-examination of Mr. Johnson based on these other things, given that he didn't have particular facts? I mean, obviously, you're not going to let defense counsel just roam all over the universe just saying, maybe you were prejudiced here, maybe you were prejudiced there.
Is Your Honor referring to the points where the state's objections were sustained
right. On
the convictions? That's
right. Because
they had not been reduced to convictions, and so they could not be impeaching under, say, 404B or some other things. Whenever Mr. Miracle, the trial counsel, defendant's trial counsel, formed the words in the right way and the question in the right way that, weren't you arrested on these, the state's objections were overruled. Mm-hmm. And they were allowed to proceed. So the trial court was merely applying the rules of evidence and having the right questions asked before implying that these had been reduced to convictions and that, in fact, Mr. Johnson is guilty. Although he actually admitted to committing the church burglary on the stand.
Yeah. It seems to me, I mean, it's sort of too bad. I don't understand why the state has argued, as I understand it, so vociferously that unless there's an agreement, there's nothing. Because, you know, there are a lot of cases where benefits are conferred, one of the most notorious being this court's in the United States against Boyd, where all manner of benefits are being showered on defendants. And Brady and Giglio and all of these cases speak of impeaching evidence. I don't speak of a duty to disclose agreements. They, you know, exculpatory or, in this case, impeaching evidence. And so it seems to me the real issue here is, had benefits been bestowed upon Mr. Johnson, and obviously, you know, subsidiary or preliminary issue is, was that clearly presented to the Indiana Supreme Court? And if benefits had been bestowed, as the Indiana court seems to think in footnote 50 of its post-conviction opinion, why did the state not disclose those in response to the discovery motion for defense counsel to have something concrete? I mean, for all I know, it would have made no difference. It's a terribly brutal murder. You had a confession. There were all sorts of other things. But I don't understand why you took such a narrow approach to the disclosure obligation.
Throughout state court, and the state court briefs belie this point, the argument was about a traditional agreement, quid pro quo, maybe not a formal agreement that's written down, but a, I'm going to help you out here, Mr. Johnson. That was the argument in state court. That's the reason the Indiana Supreme Court did it. Never before was this parsed out.
If we go back and look at the briefs, though, is that what we're going to find? I mean, it seems to me this really needs to be nailed down.
In the state's opinion, that is what it is. And the reason why the state has not argued before on a procedural default on this is because it was not clear from the opening briefs to this court that, in fact, What we weren't talking about was the same thing that the district court discussed and the same thing that the Indiana Supreme Court discussed and the same thing that the state has argued in its briefs. It is not until this argument or perhaps the reply brief, to the extent that that's clear, that we really have narrowed down the issue and finally we have a...
But how can you really reconcile that with footnote 4 if before the district court here, in the memorandum in support of the petition for the writ of habeas corpus, there's a citation to page 7, note 5, in which it says, you know, Weishaar raised a third and related issue that the state suppressed an agreement. He does not press that claim here. So, I mean, already there's, I mean, that's at the district court level, not here.
Well,
is it you didn't understand the difference, or was it... What's the issue?
Claims can be reformulated in any number of ways at any point in time in the proceedings. That was apparently one avenue that was taken in the district court. We responded to the brief that was filed and the arguments that were made there.
But the district court thought it was only an agreement issue. I mean, it just seems to me... I just don't know whether the lack of clarity is Mr. Weishaar's fault, in which case he's going to pay a pretty high price for it, or whether the lack of clarity is that courts were kind of thinking agreement and not, as it were, getting out of the box and realizing that benefits were a different point.
Well, if I take a step back, if the state had read these arguments differently, it's not the state's intention to vigorously argue just one and not all of these. Perhaps a more narrow view than should have been taken was. That's in your Honor's judgment. However, the ultimate argument made by the state is, regardless of an agreement, A, the jury was aware of all the operative facts, and B, this one additional fact would not have been material given the fact that there was a confession that is corroborated by the evidence and that Weishaar knew things that only the killer, someone who was there, would know.
His
reporting the crime and using the right language.
Right.
Johnson's testimony as the Indiana Supreme Court, he was not a star witness. I mean, the state would like to be very clear about that.
But the Indiana Supreme Court thinks he's very important, and he seems particularly to be important on, to my way of thinking anyway, the mental state issue at the sentencing phase. If he really was unbalanced, as some of the psychiatric testimony indicated, that's important. And, of course, there are other claims. It's a mysterious case in some ways. There are other claims that sort of disappeared along the way, like the fact that there might have been a couple of accomplices that strike me as more than a little interesting from sentencing. But I know they're not here, so that's you don't need to address that.
You know, the importance of the Indiana Supreme Court said there was the really important part. The important part of Prager Scott Johnson's testimony is his authentication of Weishaar's letters, several of which were entered in the trial court record during his testimony. The rest was, to quote the Indiana Supreme Court, a sideshow. And it is in those letters where really we learn that Weishaar, it corroborates Johnson's testimony about...
But wait a
for lack
minute.
Of a better term.
I just have to interrupt you and say on page... This is in the appendix, page 22... Part 8, capital A, they say, as noted supra, Gregory Scott Johnson was a key prosecution witness. I didn't write that. The Indiana Supreme Court wrote that. So for you to stand here and say he's a sideshow makes it sound like he, you know, the Indiana Supreme Court thinks he's important. Now, you may be right. There may have been enough, you know, before the jury, that the prejudice finding, there are all manner of wrinkles to this case, but I just am uncomfortable with this belittling approach.
Perhaps, Your Honor, I can be more clear to clarify this. It's not that Gregory Scott Johnson's entire testimony was a sideshow. It's that where he was a key important witness in the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion is in the fact that he authenticated these letters, which tell us a whole number of things about Weishaar, his plans, and can be read into it, then his sanity. The Indiana Supreme Court called Gregory Scott Johnson, the remainder of his testimony, a sideshow. That is not the state's words. That is the Indiana Supreme Court's words. So I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I suggesting, I mean, he is an important witness, and we can see this in the brief, but he's not the key witness. He's not the crux of this case. It's Weishart's confession and the corroboration of it, I mean, by not only the facts of the crime, but also these letters, which were authenticated and aren't subject to being lied about or related even to the credibility.
Well, the letters just show Weishart is kind of a disgusting, crazy guy. I mean, he's talking about these lists of crimes he's committed, and he hasn't done murder and rape yet, and so on. I mean, I don't know how much they tell us about what happened on that particular day.
No, but what they do is they counteract the false the two defenses that Weishart put forth at trial, that he falsely confessed, and the reason why
Why did they do that? Because crazy people don't write crazy letters, or because something else?
There's nothing in the letters to suggest that Weishart is in fact crazy. I mean, the crazy theory was that he was just brought up. I mean,
right.
That he was crazy from the beginning. It's
right.
a bit of a stretch, in the state's opinion. It is a bit of a stretch to say that Weishart's crimes were anything, that his crimes were brought about by a long-standing mental illness, that he just wanted to hold up an old elderly person and kill anyone who got in his way, or however he puts it at various times. That's not what the testimony at trial about the mental illness really was. So the letters, Weishart's own words, rebut his claim of false confession and the insanity. That is why it's important. Perhaps reasonable minds may disagree upon whether or not that actually rebuts, but that was the key portion of, in the Indiana Supreme Court's mind and the state's mind. That's where Johnson was most important. But Johnson, no one ever portrayed Johnson as being an angel. And in fact, to the extent he tried to make self-serving statements that he asked the Lord's forgiveness, the fact that he admits these crimes and as early as just 2 weeks before had been arrested for public intoxication and attempted theft of police ammunition, of all things, belies his sort of newfound religion. He impeached himself in his testimony. Mr. Miracle did a thorough job with the evidence he knew. And the only thing that he would have known was that the police didn't pursue the charges because Gregory Scott Johnson was going to be testifying. That was implied, however, through the whole thing.
How long was the cross-examination of Johnson? Do you know?
In pages, I just read it this morning. It was the letters are a part of it, and so it's hard to say exactly how many pages. It was a fairly lengthy. It was not hundreds of pages. It was not even 100 pages, I don't believe. But it was a lengthy cross-examination. Almost all of it was attacking his credibility in any way in which his credibility could be attacked. And as we know, especially after the fact, Johnson's testimony is... I mean, Johnson is not the most...
Johnson's on death row, right?
He is. And the reason he is because he felt... The reason he committed his crimes... is because he felt remorse for testifying against Weishart and putting his blood brother in jail, which is the reason why his recantation of the request on part of Weishart to make it look like he was crazy, that recantation of PCR some 10 or 11 years after trial and well after his convictions for capital murder. I mean, that's extremely self-serving testimony to help out his friend.
Let me ask you for a minute about the Remmer issue, because there were a couple of things that concerned me in the Indiana court's treatment of that. First of all, it seemed to think that private communications with one juror was never a problem, that you had to have communication to the full jury, which is not the way I read Remmer. And secondly is the idea that the state puts forward that Remmer isn't good law, because I would think that's a question of law that each circuit has to decide for itself. And as we know, sometimes circuits do disagree, but if in this circuit we think Remmer is good law, it's the Supreme Court. We don't regard ourselves as entitled to overrule it.
Certainly. I see that as a two-part question.
It's definitely two aspects.
First, the state doesn't read Remmer also to imply that the whole jury has to be tainted. I don't even believe in Remmer, which is a bribery case, if I remember correctly, that all the jury was bribed.
No, it was a juror, actually, which is why the fact that it's one here. I mean, I agree with Judge Posner. Forget about anybody else. But there's an affidavit from the one juror.
And the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion does suggest that.
But it has to be the whole jury. It seems
that's correct. However, it's the result, the adjudication that's at issue under 2254D, and that result is reasonable, objectively reasonable, so long as it's at least minimally consistent with the law and the facts.
But what rebuts the presumption of prejudice that this court only recently has ruled Remmer requires us to use? I'm thinking of our Moore decision, which applied Remmer, deemed presumptively prejudicial. The prejudice is not conclusive, but the burden rests heavily upon the government to establish, after notice and hearing to the defendant, that the contact was harmless. So aren't we missing a piece of the puzzle here in this case, namely the rebuttal?
No. The affidavit is self-rebutting, and let me explain. The affidavit says that this juror learned that Weishart was taking, not that he had failed or passed or that the results were inconclusive, it was just taking a polygraph exam. That was during the trial. After that, the jurors were given their instructions in which they were only to consider the evidence and nothing else that they may know or that they may have heard, et cetera, the standard sort of jury instruction, a number of very lengthy jury instructions. Then, of course, there's just the nature of just learning that he was taking a polygraph exam. The jury never learned the results of those polygraph exams. And so the most reasonable assumption on the part of a juror who knew that he took it is that it wasn't favorable to anyone. Otherwise, why wouldn't the state or the defense put forth? Although
in note 72 of the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion, they say, we acknowledge that generally references to polygraph exams are inadmissible absent a stipulation. So they're not saying results or anything. If you start talking about polygraphs, you're going down an impermissible line.
Yes. The state's point is, though, that a juror doesn't know what the rules of evidence are. They don't know what is or is not admissible.
Right, so but underneath it, why do you think references to polygraphs would be inadmissible?
Under Indiana law, the polygraph exams are inadmissible unless both parties.
What do they mean by references? Do they mean references to the results?
Well, that is the inadmissible evidence, is the results.
I think they'd be concerned about references to results, not to...
Well, it says references to polygraph exams, and I would think if you know that somebody's taken a polygraph and he's still on trial, there's some risk that the jury would draw an inference that he flunked it.
That I think is the concern, and hence the reason. If we could change the, if I may suggest a similar hypothetical, had say Officer Moberly testified at trial. Well, we gave him the polygraph exam, and before he gave any sort of more information, the prosecutor or the judge or the defense stopped his statement. There would be a curative instruction, and that instruction would be the same one that was given to the jury. The intent of it is to exactly head off the problems that are suggested in this case. So there is no, I guess what ultimately the state's argument about the rebutting is that there was no rebutting needed because the affidavit didn't even rise to the level of something that needs to be rebutted by more evidence. I mean, the evidence in the trial and the and what happened regarding jury instructions and the nature of what the juror learned are exactly it. I mean, not all extraneous information should give rise to the rebuttable presumption.
Well, of course not. I mean, if you found out what he had for breakfast that morning, nobody would worry about, you know, holding a hearing under Remmer and all the rest of it. But a polygraph isn't quite the same thing.
Yes, and had the parties learned that the jurors would have, or at least one juror would have, they would have, the remedy would not have been a mistrial. It would have been a curative instruction and disregard that piece of information. And that's exactly
And the whole worry is that there was no such curative instruction. So for all we know, that juror went back into the jury room and said, well, I found out, you know, that he had a polygraph, and obviously here we are. We don't know, of course, because the jury room is sacrosanct and all the rest of it. But there's a risk, and I think that's what the court's worried about in Remmer, when one of the jurors has become tainted and there's no opportunity for that focused kind of curative instruction that you're hypothesizing. And, you know, instead they just sit there and listen to a lot of boilerplate. It's a little different. They don't know what they're supposed to be paying attention to.
Well, curative instruction make it worse, wouldn't it, as a practical matter?
Well, it very well could. I mean, for example, that would
not to think about a pink elephant or something. Put it out of your mind.
Well, that's true of all curative instructions, in which case we should just abandon that part of the law, don't you think?
Or leave it up to the parties to decide what risks they want to take, which is really ultimately.
But of course,
what
they had no opportunity to make that decision at this trial because they didn't know.
No, but the final jury instructions did include that language. So, regardless of whether or not it was an immediate curative instruction or it was near the end, from what I my recollection is that this delay was during Weishart's case in chief. And so that was very close to the end of the trial. So this wasn't this was not like this was at the beginning of trial or during, jury selection. The Moore case dealt with information given by a bailiff that misrepresented the evidence during jury deliberations. This case is significantly different from that. If I may address the second part of Judge Wood's question, which was the state's argument is that Remmer is not the application of Remmer to these sorts of cases is not clearly established federal law because there's a circuit split on that they would even apply to these cases. That the circuit split is about how serious of a extraneous information, such as bribery, for example, which is just inherently prejudicial. There's really no way of getting around that absent some very strong evidence.
But that all depends on construing what the Supreme Court has said. This is not up to us. I mean, I know the state has pointed out some later Supreme Court decisions. Obviously, we'll look at that. But it's not the same as, you know, trying to figure out, you know, some new rule of law, which, of course, courts of appeals are not entitled to do under the AEDPA statute.
No, but even this court's decision is merely persuasive authority on the Indiana Supreme Court.
Oh, I don't mean our court decision has any effect. It's Remmer that's binding on the Indiana Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court of the United States has not changed Remmer, it really doesn't make any difference what the courts of appeals are doing. That's got to be a two-way street. You can't say the courts of appeals can only narrow and not expand.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the last point I don't disagree with, but your general premise I do disagree with. And here's, let me explain.
But what, federal courts of appeals can change the scope of a Supreme Court decision?
No, but they can look at all of the law on the issue since Remmer and say that the Supreme Court has effectively narrowed Remmer. And while not explicitly overruling it, the facts in Remmer are this, but in other cases with less egregious extraneous information, we don't apply the Remmer presumption to the state. And so, therefore, Remmer must stand for something different.
But
and that's what several
circuits
have said.
The courts of appeals who have said that could be completely wrong. What still binds the Indiana Supreme Court is Remmer, or Remmer plus subsequent Supreme Court decisions. That's the issue.
I would point the court to the Sixth Circuit case. I don't have the name or the site off the top of my head that I cite in that
right.
The state cites in its brief,
yeah.
Which is that when there's a split on the Court of Appeals about a matter, and the United States Supreme Court's opinions seem to be in conflict with one another, that it is not clearly established law under 2254D. Remmer does not, the Remmer presumption is not clearly established law. However, that all, unless you have a very similar case to Remmer, that's the state's argument. However, all of that is largely beside the point for the reasons that I discussed below. And it's an academic question that perhaps is controlling another case or interesting in general. The state recognizes, though, that it is what it is. If there are no further questions, the state asks that this court affirm the denial of the writ of habeas corpus.
Thanks, Creason. Ms. Longsharp, your time had expired, but in light of the case, you may have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to direct the court's attention to a couple of parts of the state post-conviction brief and the briefs in the district court. The state post-conviction brief, issue 4-1, pages 82 to 89, the reference is made to the prosecutor failed to completely and accurately respond to the motion to reveal agreements. Again, that's the name of the discovery motion. The argument goes on to talk about the benefits, quote-unquote, that Johnson was receiving. There is no allegation in that in those 7 pages of argument of the existence of a deal.
But look, why is the receipt of benefits significant? It's significant because it implies a deal. Unless you think maybe there's some gratitude issue here. If I got a benefit from the state, well, you know, I'm a good person, Mr. Johnson. I am. So I'm grateful and I'm gonna play ball with him. That's not realistic. Right? The benefits are part of the... See, the problem is, I think, that agreement has been used very loosely to mean either an explicit agreement or some kind of informal quid pro quo understanding, expectation, and so on. Right?
Yes. I mean, Giglio speaks in those terms, a concrete agreement, I believe, or an understanding.
Hasn't the argument always been that there was an understanding?
No.
But then you just said Giglio is about an understanding.
Well, the term...
And that's one of the cases you recite. I don't understand it. I think it's all words myself.
Let me try this. Maybe I'll... a benefit that Johnson got was freedom. He got to skate. He got to skate on the felony theft. He got to skate on the
church.
Right,
and the jury knew that.
They didn't even know that he was arrested for felony theft. They knew he was arrested for public intoxication. They didn't know that this was just 2 weeks before he took the stand and testified. They knew none of that. They didn't know that he asked the police officers to make it go away. But the benefit of... I mean, there are a lot of benefits that one can get in banks and Bagley. The currency is money. Any of us who have been around the criminal courts know that there is a currency far more valuable than cash, and that's freedom. And that's what Johnson got time and time again.
Yeah, but as you say, the reason benefits are significant is that there's an implied quid pro quo.
Well, I think they're relevant to bias. So, am I going to testify to curry the favor of the people who are giving me
freedom?
You're
not going to testify unless you think you're going to get something for it, right?
Well, I hope that's not why everyone testifies.
No, these people.
But they already have gotten. Why are they testifying if they've already gotten something?
Well, as far as Johnson is concerned, it seems to me that this relationship that Johnson's got with the police is pretty significant, and he wants to keep it going. I mean, he's got a free pass. For anything he does, he's walking. He's getting his freedom. And all he has to do to get that is to say, please. That, to me, is pretty significant. Again, the currency of freedom is huge. Let me also briefly direct the court's attention to, and I apologize for not having the date it was filed. It's the first brief filed in district court after the state filed its return to show cause. Section A1, page 7, Weishart raises 2 separate but related claims. We discuss what those are. Then in footnote 5, Weishart raised a third and related issue in his habeas petition, parentheses, that the state suppressed an agreement it had with Johnson, in print. He does not press that claim here. Respondent answered that claim in its memorandum, et cetera, but it did not provide a response to the 2 claims that Weishart continues to press. That we were not claiming the deal.
And the 2 claims were what?
The 2 claims were the Brady claim, the suppression
of... What did they say? What did the brief say? How did the brief describe the 2 claims?
Weishart raises 2 separate but related claims, and I quote, one, the prosecution failed to correct the false testimony of its star witness, Gregory Scott Johnson, parentheses, hereafter, NAPU claim, in parentheses. 2, the prosecution suppressed impeachment material central to Johnson's credibility, in paren, Brady Kyle's claim.
Isn't that the agreement?
No. I mean, we're very specific that there is an actual deal claim. In the habeas petition, we even say there are three things here. The actual deal claim, this benefits claim, that even if there wasn't an actual deal, as the state Supreme Court said there was still something that the state had to do, and that was turn over the information that was twice specifically requested.
No, but it was requested under the heading of an agreement.
Well, the discovery motion, Your Honor, is at page 122 of the trial transcript, and that discovery motion, the heading is cutesy. The content of the discovery motion is unambiguous. We are requesting any information about, and he lists probably 20 or 30 things, and one of those is non-prosecution of any state's witness or potential state's witness. We'd like to have deals as well, but anything that could be used to impeach the witnesses, in particular Johnson, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right, thanks to all counsel, Mr. Creason, Ms. Rhonda Long, and Mr. Friedman. Ms. Rhonda Long, I have an additional thanks for accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner. And Ms. Friedman, a special thanks to the Center, the Midwest Center, for assisting Capitol Counsel in these cases. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.